You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Comrades, this is your host of the Daily Traditionalist, Matt Heimbach, and I'm happy here to close out another great week of our show. I'm joined by one of our activists and one of my good friends, my good buddy Frank. And Frank is joining us on location before he has to do the white man's burden of going to work. So, Frank, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, Matt. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm happy to be here. Happy to see the Nationalist Revolution rolling forward. So it's very good times. But I want to kick off just by introducing you to our listeners. So give them your testimony. Where do you come from, and what's your story?
All right. Well, my story is my name is Frank. I was born and raised in New York, and lived there for a good part of my life. I sort of grew up, obviously, for those that know, New York is one of the most diverse cities in the world. I sort of grew up around, different cultures, different races, sort of the real sort of quote-unquote diversity that everybody wants to push nowadays. And I started becoming more of a nationalist and more red-pilled about a couple of years back, and ever since then, it's just grown exponentially, and now I'm starting to consider myself definitely more of a white nationalist, definitely more of a racial nationalist of sorts, and even, my politics could best be described as fascist in a way, more along the lines of, Mussolini, Franco, the Falangists, those sort of guys. Those are more the guys I tend to follow politically. Mosley as well is a big influence on me. But right now I'm in Philadelphia. I just moved, and I had a couple of setbacks in Philadelphia for around the time I was moving, but, I'm here to keep carrying that same message that I did in New York. Be a nationalist, fight for our people, fight for the Overton window to be shifted more on our end. I'm not sure if anybody I'm Facebook friends with is on my wall, but I posted a picture around the time of Trump's election where I saw a small group of Asians, supporting Trump, and just all these different people all recognizing that our current president will make America great again. Even us, even he'll make our movement great again, even if he's not officially one of us. So it's just a pretty interesting introduction there.
Well, exactly. And, it's an interesting thing. Our both of our mutual friend and party member, Jason Augustus, of course, was raised in New York and became a refugee to flee here to Indiana. So there seems to be this thing. I know a couple more guys in New York that are looking to move out of New York. What drove you from New York? I mean, this is a really big step, in all honesty. I mean, to leave behind what you know, what you were raised with, but it seems like your story is one that's shared by a lot of people, and probably a lot of our listeners, whether it's New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, there's a whole bunch of different places where you see that white youth especially don't feel that they have a future. They don't have the money of previous generations, the opportunities to wall themselves off in these gated communities, or to be able to buy themselves a place in a gentrified community. What they face is on the streets, not having job opportunities, being iced out of the economy. If you can get a job, not having a very good one. And in many ways, it's a hostile environment to be, especially a young white person. So what drove you to make this radical change? I think it's such an interesting thing, and we're seeing it, just within our party members doing this, many of them besides you and Jason. But what really drove you? What made New York it wasn't doing it for you. So what drove you to make the change?
Well, it was exactly as you highlighted. There wasn't very many opportunities for a young white person. You are literally in a hostile environment, not always openly, but sometimes, we hear stories of, the black on white crimes, or just the general milieu of, this anti-white sort of, rhetoric is going on, especially in the major cities, especially in colleges. The same thing that drove Jason and me out of New York was honestly the fact that New York is astonishingly expensive. So there's an economic drive as well. And also just the atomization that a hectic city like New York is going to usually bring. Jason and I grew up, we weren't surrounded by our people, by our race. We were surrounded by others. And trust me, they would never hesitate to let you know that you were different. You were the different one. You were the outnumbered one. You were the literal minority. So it was a combination of economic factors that led me out, a combination of the fact that, you know, I do know some white activists in and around the Pennsylvania area. And in addition, I just, you know, and the gun laws also as well. You know, New York has a notoriously strict gun laws. You can't carry at all unless you're very politically connected or you're a cop. You know, so Pennsylvania, by comparison, and even Philly has more lenient gun laws by comparison. So it was a combination of the need for self-defense, a combination of economics, and a combination of the sheer fact that, you know, I needed something resembling a sense of community and something to counteract all the atomization and the social isolation I had in New York. So that's definitely the main reasons I left.
Well, and this is, I mean, just understanding the principles of white flight. We've seen over the past 60 years that that whites have been fleeing the cities because it's not a home for us. We know the Jewish oligarchs and other well-connected Gentile minions and lackeys always have enough money, like you were talking about, to live in these places of privilege. But they create these hostile environments. And you think about what multiculturalism is. It is this atomization where you don't feel part of a community because you're not surrounded by your people. I mean, where are you supposed to integrate to? You know, every ethnic community that has ever come to America, they go and they establish Chinatown. They go and establish their own ethnic community that they're going to live in, where their language is spoken, where their music is played, where their folk traditions are maintained. That's normal, natural, and healthy. But nowhere in America, you know, in our major cities, is there a space for everyday white folks to be able to live in a white community, to live in a community that is for us, that maintains our traditions, where we are the norm. We're always told that that's a non-diverse neighborhood. So that's where the next group of refugees have to go. That's where the next group of development goes, to put Section 8 housing, to be able to house other ethnic communities within our borders. There is no place for us in these major cities. And is that something you've seen in New York, just this purposeful breaking down, this blockbusting of traditional white communities? Because there used to be a large number of white working class communities in New York City.
Oh, yeah. And I can tell you firsthand, I was living in Brooklyn before I moved down to Philly, and I saw firsthand how the Jews, whether Orthodox or not, they would literally blockbust. They would go door to door, and it wouldn't matter where they knocked. They would knock on a Latino building. They'd knock on a white building, like the few Polish or, you know, Italians that have been living there for, like, you know, 30 to 50 years. They would knock on, you know, a black home, you know, just different places, and they would always ask, you know, oh, are you selling, guy? You are looking to sell your house? I'll give you a good price there. And, you know, that was how they did it. And they would buy out an entire block, because let's be honest, they have money and, you know, and a large, you know, community presence wherever they go. You know, they would buy up the whole block, and then they would rent it out for obscene prices. And, you know, I'm curious as to whether this echoes in the in the major city. Yeah, I caught that one. But I'm curious as to whether there's an echo in every major city. But I can tell you, at least in New York, you know, you've got, you know, young people trying to make the rent work. And they're, like you said, there's not a lot of job opportunities. The jobs you do get aren't very good. So you're stuck working two jobs and living with five other people in a small apartment trying to just split the rent, you know, because average rents in New York by now are probably about 2,000 and up, roundabouts. Or even to try to rent a room in New York, it's getting more and more expensive. And it's just the sheer cost of living. We all want to say capitalism isn't a good thing, and it's not, just, you know, by this example. But I will say this, though, if you have more money, you have more options on what to do with life. You know, it's not to say money buys you happiness. Happiness is something that's going to come from a lot of something very different. But, you know, if you're limited on money, and I can tell you this from experience, I can tell you this from being poor, being homeless, working whatever minimum wage job I could, you know, if you have limited amounts of money, you have very limited options, and it sort of handcuffs you in the sense to whatever you can grab that's cheap, even if it's not always good.
So, well, I mean, and with this, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing that every other ethnic community, I mean, I've seen it in major cities here, and I've heard stories and seen it myself in news reports and stuff about how every other ethnic community has advocacy groups to help if you're Latino or if you're Black or, of course, if you're Jewish,
absolutely.
To be able to have people to help you fill out paperwork to get government assistance. They have charities and institutions to be able to provide support and things like that. But if you're an average everyday white person, you're essentially on your own. Every other group has these advocates to help them, but white folks sure as heck don't have one. And if they did, then they'd be called they'd be called racist. They'd be attacked for violating civil rights when it would just be giving the exact same opportunities to our people that every other group already has, and that's how they get by.
Absolutely, and I've noticed that firsthand. You know, I've noticed that, you know, and I will say this, though, at least in New York, a lot of these, like, you know, nonprofits or advocacy groups, they are Jewish run. So you can already sort of smell it a mile away as to what might be coming. You know, even if you're a normie, even if you don't run in the same circles we do, you can still get a sense that something is wrong, because the people that do not deserve it, and I mean that literally, the people that do not deserve, you know, government aid or charity or help filling out paperwork or whatever, they always get it. But the people that work, that bust their ass, and, you know, it's mainly white people, but I've seen a couple of, you know, other races that, you know, make an attempt to work hard and, you know, get by. But, you know, like you said, if you're white, you're shit out of luck. If you are, you know, Jewish, or if you are a ghetto piece of trash, you're going to get it automatically. Like, and I mean literally automatically. And I've heard stories and I've seen it of people waiting for aid for, you know, 2 weeks. They're missing work. They're getting further and further into a downward spiral because they can't get anywhere. But the people that don't care, that don't give a damn, they get it immediately. And like you said, that's a pernicious double standard. It's a disgusting double standard, to be honest.
Well, and if you just see within our society, I mean, this is going everywhere. I mean, when it comes to jobs, you know, you get preferential treatment. You know, through affirmative action programs, if you're not white,
absolutely.
Or if you're a different orientation, or whatever it is, anything out of if you're a white normal person, you know, anyone who, if you go back to talk to our ancestors in 1955, probably, you know, ask our grandparents, you know, what's normal. If you fit that description they put out, then you're out of luck, and it really is anti-white policies. It's anti-white policies in hiring. In government assistance, it's anti-white policies in terms of rent and everything like that, because we just don't have political force. And when you don't have political force, then you can't advocate for yourselves. You can't defend yourselves against the system. And they really prey on us individually. It's like they cut the gazelle from the herd to eat it, and the herd doesn't realize it's more powerful together. So they kept letting themselves be broken off. And if white folks, like gazelles, came together, we can all go and we can stomp the Jewish lions, the capitalist lions, to death, and then the water hole is ours, you know? But this system, it comes to our identity, and not having this concrete identity on what we need to be able to have to advocate for ourselves, advocate for our families, advocate for our communities. So I've got to ask, you know, you're talking about Mussolini, about Franco, about Sir Oswald Mosley, what brought you to fascism? I mean, you know, it's we all take the journey, but what got you started on this? What was your first red pill?
I mean, I think obviously living in New York is a sort of a steady trickle of red pills in and of itself. I think the thing that really sort of snapped it together was initially I came to it because I was looking for some way of motivation outside my faith. You know, I mean, my faith, you know, I'm a Norse pagan, but I was looking for some sort of internal motivation that would drive me just as much as my faith would. And me being deep into politics and philosophy and studying those things in my spare time, I happened to actually read this book called The Doctrine of Fascism. And, you know, you've seen me probably post it a couple of times every now and then, or post Mussolini quotes and things like that. But I read that entire book, and I think that was what sort of pulled me into fascism more and more. I mean, and I initially started out in fascism because I think when I was first getting into this movement, I met a few Nordicists, and they were the sort of, you know, the misguided people that would try to say that if you were Southern European, you know, for those who don't know, my heritage is mainly French. But it's, you know, they would try to argue that, oh, if I was Southern European, I was somehow not white. And, you know, I kind of got turned away from that whole type of movement. So that was how I stumbled onto fascism initially. But the more I read Mussolini, the more I read Mosley, the more I, you know, just saw the philosophical basis behind fascism and the doctrine of fascism and how sort of would help one evolve and become a better person in a sort of Nietzschean way, I think it appealed to me more and more as time went on.
Well, with that, I mean, understanding the philosophical underpinnings of fascism and National Socialism, which is about self-preservation of your people, and it's about personal growth, and it's about national growth, it's about community growth. Everything about it is organic, where this natural law, regardless of your faith tradition in the European context, whether you're Christian or a folk religionist, we all understand that to live is to support life, is to love life, is to be able to encourage life, just like a farmer will grow his crops and he'll nurture them and he'll pluck the weeds. You know, he'll kill the bugs so that they'll be the plants will grow and it'll be healthy. And everything about fascism is about health. It's about the health of the individual, the health of the family, the health of the nation. This is organic. So what do you say to people, you know, especially, you know, these leftists that when they, you know, with their ideology, these social justice warriors, versus the doctrine of fascism, the idea of what's best for the people and the nation seems like a pretty clear-cut thing. Bringing economic justice, bringing social justice, bringing a future. I mean, that's what fascism inherently is by its very doctrines. But these so-called social justice warriors love everything that is bad for the individual. You know, I was just watching a video yesterday where it was a girl that it was talking about, you know, it was chubby girl problems. And it was like, no, it's morbid obesity problems, and, you know, talking about being in, like, a normal room and being overheated constantly and being unhealthy, and they're trying to normalize obesity. They're trying to normalize weakness, and, like, I need to hit the gym more, and I know that, but I know that I have a shortcoming and that as a National Socialist, I have a responsibility to make myself stronger and to help my brothers be stronger, to help my sisters be stronger in mind, body, and soul. You don't normalize weakness. Weakness is degenerative. It's bad for everybody, but the left, everything, whether it's fat acceptance or accepting, like, perversions, you know, if I say to you that I want to have my hand be cut off because I identify as a one-handed person, you would say it's mental illness, but if you want to cut your junk off, then that's called liberation. It's called normal. They're normalizing everything that's poison. So what do you say to these people, many of whom, you know, we're millennials that are young like us, who, you know, want to support weakness, want to roll around in the slop like a pig, sometimes literally like a pig, of everything that is degenerate? You know, what do you say to them in this philosophy? And what do you say to, you know, the average young white listener who might be tuning in for the first time on what this doctrine of fascism really means to you?
Absolutely. There's plenty I could say, but I'll try to condense it as best I can for the sake of the show. But with the SJW thing, I chuckled when you mentioned social justice because it's become so perverted nowadays that it's like the word progress. I've come to sort of spit on it every time it's being said, mainly because of the people who normally espouse those views nowadays. You know, and I know where the social justice originally comes from. It comes from Father Charles Kaufman. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right, but, you know, from that father back in the 30s who, you know, spoke about true social justice. What I'll say to these, you know, to these SJWs is that they're doing it all wrong. They're forgetting that, you know, being weak sucks. Being weak is humiliating. You know, there's no pride in being a victim. There's no pride in trying to fight off your and trying to sort of pull everybody low. You know, pull society low, and, you know, destroy, you know, everything good about society. And, you know, even just normal people trying to live their lives and, you know, just make the best that they can, you know, it's direct attack on them as well. As to the young white listener, I mean, that's honestly how I was, you know, when I first got started, and that's how I see myself. I see myself as trying to be something of a beacon for those types of listeners. I'll say to this, if anybody's out there listening and you can detect that something's wrong in our society, I'm not going to try to sway you one way or the other. I'll just say what works for me. I'll just say what I've read. I'll be happy to give you the resources. I'll be happy to sort of point you on the right path if you ask me, if you come to me, and if you want to have an honest discussion about what's going on in our society and how can it be better. But I'll be more than happy to let you make your own organic decision. And if it comes to fascism and the National Socialism, perfect. I'll bring you into that type of circle. And if you take a different path, that like a parallel path but with different methods, that's fine as well. And what we all forget is that every SJW, every leftist, you know, garbage we have nowadays, all descends from communism, all descends from the Frankfurt School, which is both of them are heavily Jewish inventions. You know, communism is a literal Jewish, method, and it's just as internationalist and degenerate as rampant capitalism. So I think that's what you know, we see nowadays, and we need to start finding solutions to those types of problems and sort of trying to figure out how can we pull people on the right path. The good news about all this, though, is that the left is sort of giving themselves the rope to hang themselves. With all the perversity and ridiculousness coming out of the left, and even the violence coming out of the left, we're getting more normal people at least to look at us, you know, to look at our movement, our views, or at least to swing a little more right, because the left has become so unpalatable, it's ridiculous at this point.
Well, I mean, you really hit on an interesting thing there, of where there is no middle. I mean, the left, of course, they declare themselves anti-fascist, and they've been anti-fascist when they were organizing against Ron Paul. They were anti-fascist when they were organizing against, like, Mitt Romney in 2012, saying Mitt Romney is literally Hitler. You know, on a college campus, if you support Donald Trump, who is the president-elect of the United States, who had tens of millions of people vote for him, well, then you're literally Hitler. I mean, there comes a point where, you know, and I went through this progression. I used to be leaning to the left, even when I kind of came conservative. I was a Zionist, because I was, like, just the de facto what you were, you know, in the early 2000-teens. But eventually, it comes to this point where it's like, you're a fascist, you're a fascist, you're a fascist. Eventually, you just sit down and you're
embrace
like,
the label.
Yeah, okay.
No,
yeah,
but like,
there is no political center anymore.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, there was a little bit of that sort of mentality there, because, you know, even when I was a conservative, you know, I went from being, like, when I was little, I bought into the nonsense that, you know, I was being taught in the schools, and they do teach a lot of, like, leftist talking points in schools and, you know, diversity, and we are all one race, and blah, blah, blah. But I never fully embraced all of it. I embraced, like, half of it, the whole human race garbage. But, you know, I as I grew older, I got more conservative, and I think I became conservative when I was in my junior year of high school. And then I just kept getting more and more right as time went on. Now I consider myself fascist, third positionist. There are certain, you know, you could call them leftist positions on things that I'll take. But my majority thing is mainly right. And part of it was because even when I was like your average conservative, I would get called a Nazi. I get called a fascist. I get called, you know, I got called a warmonger more times than I can think of, you know, which is hilarious. But, you know, there's definitely that sort of motivation where you keep getting that label applied to you, fascist, as you said, and you learn to embrace it. And when you read it, you're just like, oh, thanks for the compliment.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, for instance, talking about the, you know, the idea of warmongering. I mean, Sir Oswald Mosley, the BUF, their main point up to World War II, which became the worst brothers war in European history. The entire platform of the BUF was Mosley's for peace. The BUF is for peace. They wanted to keep that. Mosley was a veteran. You know, he was a lord. He had a responsibility to his constituents, to his people. And so many of the members of the BUF served in the trenches of World War One. You know, they saw what this was like, or they were the sons of men that served in the trenches, men that didn't come home, men that came home burned by poison gas or
limbs.
Yeah, I mean, they saw what war was, and it was only the fascist movements. I mean, if you look to what Adolf Hitler spoke about, you know, the idea of trying to keep peace, and this is what in every nationalist nation during the early 20th century, they were trying to keep peace, and it was the West, it was the Churchills, it was the Roosevelts, it was the horrible Russia. You know, all of them were chomping at the bit for war. And so, what would you say that? Because, you know, one of the most important things, you know, to understand about the doctrine of fascism is that fascism is not for export, insofar as, you know, these ideas, these eternal principles of natural law, are equally applicable to everyone, but the symbols and the solutions for a nation are unique. It has to be an organic movement, and we want to be self-sufficient. You know, you want your economy to have your workers using your natural resources to provide jobs, to be able to provide opportunities, to take the things that God gave you on this planet to be able to then use them for your own people. It's about being, you know, self-determination politically, but also having a self-reliant economy and being able to mind your own business and take care of your people and make them better, make them stronger. What would you say to people that say that, you know, fascism represents war, fascism represents all these things? Because to me, fascism represents more of an inner war against ourselves to remove weakness, to remove cowardice, to remove greed, to remove anger and hatred, and be able to inspire love and promote peace in the world. So what would you say to those people that that would attack us to say that we're warmongers?
Well, I mean, I've always found it a strange irony that the very people who, you know, claim to be the most peaceful or the most violent. You'll often say that the left always says that they're anti-war, you know, no more wars for oil, rah, rah, rah. Come to find out they're some of the most violent people you would ever meet. What I enjoy about fascism is that it's anti-pacifistic, you know. It's usually the people that claim to be pacifists that turn out to be the most violent, or the people that, you know, claim to avoid conflict, that they have all that boiling inside of them and they want to let it out in, you know, different ways. And, you know, I used to be that way when I was younger, but now I've grown and evolved. You know, with fascism, it's more along the lines of anti-pacifistic, you know. We don't want, endless war. We don't want, wars in places where we don't need to be, unless it's directly related to what some would call a just war, defense of the nation, defense of our people. And it's definitely more of an anti-pacifistic attitude. And I find it interesting that, you know, the ones that claim to be anti-war constantly are absolutely not. And meanwhile, the ones that are called warmongers are the ones that are, you know, they want peace. You know, they will defend themselves if necessary, absolutely, as we should, and as we once saw in Sacramento against the Antifa. But we're not, you know, it's more along the lines of, there's an old phrase that says, if you want peace, you must prepare for war. And that's not saying have war all the time. It's saying, you know, be ready, be aware, you know, but you can bring peace while having power to back that up, because soft power will only work if backed by hard power. And that's what plenty forget nowadays.
Well, exactly. And it's about this martial culture where if you're training men, you know, especially men, but women as well, if you're training men to be strong, to be self-reliant, and to be honorable, to have a love of family, to have a love of fatherland, to have a love of the future, and have a responsibility, if you're willing to defend those things, that makes you a better individual man. That calls you to be stronger. It encourages you. And the thing about our positions is, again, everything is about life. It's about making yourself better, making you a better husband, making you a better father, making you a better friend, making you a better citizen. Everything about that, and then you come together with your brothers and your sisters to make the nation strong. Everything about our doctrines is about improving the human experience, improving the environment, improving our nation, improving our infrastructure, improving everything, improving education, improving healthcare, always striving for better, always reaching for the stars, you know, both metaphorically and literally, you know.
Yeah, it's a definite sense of a literal evolution, you know, and I think there's a phrase called, if I'm going to pronounce it correctly, palingenesis, which I, you know, it basically defines it as nationalistic evolution, where it's, you know, through hardship, through struggle, you learn what works, you learn what doesn't, you know, and you learn that constant peace is going to be, is weakening, but at the same time, endless war will grind away at you. So there has to be some sort of middle ground. And as you've said, if you're training men to be good citizens, to be good, you know, husbands and fathers, and teaching them to evolve in a better direction, in a more positive direction, you know, it's going to be worth it for both the nation and for the nation and for its people. And the reason I talk about needing to strike a balance of that sort between, you know, war and peace is because, you know, constant peace is going to lead to pacifism, which leads to weakness, which leads to death when you meet a stronger culture. But at the same time, look at Islam. Look at the way the Muslims are. Constant tribal warfare, constant infighting, constant, you know, massacres and atrocities, and it's even spilled over into the West where our people live and where, quite frankly, we need to kick all these savages out. But we can, and obviously there's definitely certain kind of influence, Jewish kind, but at the same time, it's, you know, we as the West have always had a fine balance between, you know, peace and calm and war when it's necessary. And we need to sort of hold on to that. And I think fascism is the perfect vehicle for the modern day to be able to do that.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I want to close out. This has actually been a really exciting conversation. Now you're forced to come back on. Now you volunteered yourself.
I would definitely love to come back on, that's for sure.
Well, I want to go with this closing thought, you know, especially because we're a very youth-oriented movement, because he who controls the youth controls the future.
Indeed.
And he who controls the streets controls the politics of a nation. So let's look real quick at in terms of rebellion. And I like to talk about this a lot, and I want your perspective, that the left calls themselves rebels. You know, they're fighting against this patriarchal, white supremacist, fascist America, this fascist establishment. And they're fighting for the policies of Barack Obama, of Angela Merkel, of the European Union, of multiculturalism, of abortion, of radical feminism, of all these things that are supported by, like, the Democratic Party. This isn't even, like, far left. They're supporting the positions of the mainstream, and to truly rebel is to embrace your heritage, to embrace your identity, and to become a nationalist. So I want to know your thoughts about, really, being a nationalist is the truest form of rebellion against the system, because the system is corrupt, the system is evil, the system disenfranchises us, and now we have an opportunity to build something bigger. But to the young listeners, you know, who feel that there's something wrong, and they're told, if you want to rebel, if you see this injustice, go be a leftist. But really, the only path to go is towards us, because we're the ones who actually have solutions to these problems and want to be able to make things better for us and for all future generations and the planet as a whole. So what would you say to people who, you know, feel that things are wrong, they want to rebel, and the left is telling them that the proper way to rebel is come be a leftist?
I'll say this. Take a look at who's in office, or who's been in office. Take a look at the policies in academia. Take a look at affirmative action. Take a look at the people who think they are entitled to something for nothing. That is what our current system is right now. And I'm asking all these young listeners, if you're listening to me, take a look around you. You can already sense that there's a problem. You can already sense that there's something wrong. You know, if you're white, let's be honest, you're going to get blamed for every single thing that's going wrong. And you have to really think to yourself, why? You know, why are whites the only ones being relentlessly attacked for every problem that goes on in the world? Something's wrong. It's like a woman who constantly calls out her man for cheating a million times, but come to find out that woman is cheating herself. It's a bit like that, to use that analogy, because whites are getting constantly blamed for everything else by the very people who do wrong things themselves, but they'll never admit it. So what I will say is, for the young listeners, take a look at the world around you and, you know, take a look at nationalism. Take a look at your own heritage. Start with yourself first. Start with your family. Look back in your family heritage. Look back at where you think your family might come from. If you can afford it, do a 23andMe test. And, you know, use that as a driving force. Use that as something to guide you. Because, let's be honest, the left controls everything. The left controls the media. The left controls the culture. You know, and, you know, conservatives used to always talk about a culture war, and personally, I never believed it until, you know, more recently. So I think that's going to just be something that our young listeners have to pay attention to, take a look around, and just open their eyes. You know, think about it. It doesn't even have to run into our circles right then and there. You know, you don't have to jump straight from, you know, normie to our circles. You can do what I did and go gradually, or do what you did and go gradually, piece by piece by piece by piece, until you find the truth. And I think that nationalism is going to be the best way to go about doing things, to find out who you are, where you came from, and how best to move forward on certain things.
I totally agree. And that's where we're looking. That's where we're pushing. We are the future because our principles Absolutely. Are natural, normal, and organic. It's healthy, in line with what our ancestors believe, and it's what our descendants will believe. So, Frank, I just want to thank you so much for being here today with me, and to thank all of my comrades who are listening, and we've got to look forward to being back tomorrow, or not tomorrow, on Monday, with another edition of The Daily Traditionalist. I should have Dr. Matt Johnson with me. And Frank, we're going to look forward to having you back on and being able to discuss this again. So thank you, my friend. Thank you to all my listeners, and hail victory.
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com. We'll be right back.